supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in this show, we will discuss forsythia, particularly its habit of crawling across the ground. Was that caused by a hard pruning back, or does it do it all the time? And what are the little-known benefits of this abundant spring bloomer? We'll answer all those questions after lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Yvonne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, thank you for being had, Yvonne. Where are you?
I'm in Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, it's always great to hear from our listeners down there. What can we do for Yvonne in Nashville?
Well, in my backyard, I had two peach trees, a red one and a white one. The heat for 2 years killed the red one, but the white one was still blooming, giving a lots and lots of fruit. The problem is, 2 years ago, it had been two peach, and last year, it was loaded with peach, but it continued having a disease, and I try everything humanly possible. And these big brown spots with like a clear gel on it, and it just destroyed all the fruits. And this has been going on like every 2 years, and the last 2 years it was just continuous.
Yes.
I was told what to do. I did those things and just looked like I couldn't get rid of the disease.
Well, that's because it's not a disease. I'm not quite sure who told you or what they told you to do. It terrifies me even to think about it. But when you see that amber fluid coming out of the branches and the peaches, those are caused by insects.
Okay.
On the branches, it's an insect called the peach tree borer, which kind of looks like a wasp, and it drills into the tree, and then the peach trees are full of sap, so the sap runs out.
Yes, yes.
And then there are other insects like the plum curculio and the oriental fruit moth. And especially as you get down in Tennessee and to the southern latitudes, many, many others. Peach trees are probably the most attacked backyard fruit we can have. They are perhaps the most difficult thing to grow. And they don't grow themselves. Are you pruning them or thinning the fruits?
Yes, I prune the tree, and the more I prune it, the more fruits I got.
Yeah.
It's just that these big bronze spots come on it and turn black, and it's just ugly.
Okay, well, that could be different. If you're getting brown rot on peaches, is very difficult to control. Now, let's back up. When are you pruning the trees? What time of year?
Just before the bloom starts.
Okay, excellent. And as you noted, the more branches you cut off, the more fruit you get for it.
Oh, yes.
Okay, so now do you thin the developing fruits?
Yes.
You do. You take off two for every one you leave behind.
Well, the one that I can reach, the tree, I'm on a 5'2", and the tree is like 11 feet tall.
Right. It's a standard peach tree.
Right.
But you are taking off a lot of the little developing peaches.
Yes.
Okay. So I think I have a good answer for you.
Okay.
There is a non-toxic product you can spray on the trees that's very effective at getting rid of brown rot. It's called Surround.
Okay.
And what it is a clay spray. It's a micronized clay. It's very fine clay, and it's sold in a powder. It's a white powder, and you mix it up according to the directions. You mix it up with a lot of water, and you put it in a pressurized sprayer, and then you spray that all over your trees as soon as you're done thinning the fruits.
Oh, okay.
And that actually is a physical barrier against disease and insects. Now, do you keep the area underneath the peach tree clear of any diseased fruits that fall to the ground?
Right, I did, because I was told not to let it embedded into the soil.
Very good. Now, are you feeding these trees anything?
No, just the rainwater.
Okay. If you can find some compost at like a local garden center or maybe your, you know, Nashville's a pretty hip area. There might be free municipal compost. Spread an inch of compost as a mulch underneath the peach tree. As soon as you can find the compost, you can do it now on a nice day. But spread an inch of compost underneath the tree. Keep doing your pruning. Keep doing your thinning. And then get yourself some of this Surround clay spray. The mail order supplier, Gardens Alive, they help pioneer it, and they're a good supplier. You may be able to find it at retail, but you can definitely go to the Gardens Alive website and read more about it. And it is the best protection for fruit trees.
Okay. Thank you so much. You have been a big help.
All right. Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Martin, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Martin. How are you, sir?
I'm just fine.
And where is Martin just fine?
I am in West Mount Airy in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Very good. What can we do for Martin in Mount Airy?
Well, I have a raspberry patch that I've been trying to make productive for many, many years. Last year, for example, I got wonderful green strong growth from my raspberry bushes early in the year. Got a lot of blossoms and a lot of promise. A little bit of fruit was developed, but then the season went on and nothing happened from there, and I got nothing out of my raspberry patch. I should tell you that I do not have full sun all day long, but I do have about halftime sun during the day.
Okay. And what kind of land are they growing in?
Well, it's just plain old Philadelphia soil, I guess. I don't know what anything particular about it.
And do you prune these bushes at all?
I cut them back in November, right down to the ground.
Okay.
That was what my gardener friend told me to do.
Right, because he doesn't want you to get any raspberries. He just wants to get a big crop for himself and make you feel bad.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Now, there's two different types of raspberries, basically. There are, and I always get the names confused, ever-bearing and fall-bearing. But the type I grow, which is the classic variety Heritage, is the canes will come out of the ground in the spring, the new ones. They'll grow really long. And at the end of the season, at the very end of the summer, they will flower and produce fruits just on the growing tips of the canes. Sometimes it's produced so late if we get an early frost that you don't get all the fruit off of it. But then, although some people tell you to cut those canes back, that is a fool's errand because you're exposing the crowns underneath to the full effects of any frost or cold weather. And in the spring, with this crop that bears twice, while the new canes are coming out of the ground, those old canes that look dead over winter will now turn green all up and down their little caney bodies and will produce fruit all up and down the cane. This crop that comes in the late spring, early summer, it typically is 10 times as many raspberries as I get in the fall. The other type of raspberries produces berries throughout the growing season. For instance, one of the big variety names there is Caroline. I think they're called fall-bearing, even though they should be ever-bearing. But anyway, they produce fruit slowly over the course of a whole season. But no raspberry cane should be cut back to the ground until you get to the middle of spring and it hasn't produced any greenery. I think you're actually robbing yourself of your major crop by doing the pruning. And nothing should ever be pruned in the fall. That's a misnomer. All you do is expose your plants to the worst part of winter cold. Now, you say they are getting at least 4 or 5 hours of sun a day?
Yes.
And do you feed them anything?
I have not been.
Good. And are they?
By the way, I do have the Heritage that you're talking about. That's what I've planted with.
Oh, okay. So that's exactly what's happening. And did you cut them back again last year?
Unfortunately, I did.
Yeah. So this year, just let them grow. Realize that the only crop you're going to get is off of the new canes, and that comes very late in the season. But then the following year, the year after that, if you leave those canes alone, you won't believe the enormous harvest you'll get off of it at the end of spring, early summer.
I can't wait.
And don't use any herbicides or lawn fertilizers anywhere near them. And if you do want to give them a feeding, because you have kind of been robbing them of nutrients by doing that winter pruning, just get some good quality compost and shovel it around the plants.
Okay.
But that's really it, Martin. That was the worst advice you could have been given, was to cut the plants back in November. Just leave them alone. And sorry it won't be this summer, but the summer after that, you're not going to believe how these puppies can produce.
I got it.
All right, Marty?
Okay. Thank you very much. Great advice.
Thank you, sir. Good luck.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at the fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show at 4 o'clock on Wednesday, March 15th. This year's show runs March 11th to the 19th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center in downtown Philly, and again with me on stage at 4 o'clock on Wednesday. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with Fabulous Forsythia and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm absolutely fabulous, Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in more than fabulous Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, an inquiry, or is that an inquiry, from a listener whose forsythia is beginning to creep sideways leads us to take a closer look at this fabulous spring blooming plant. What's going on when it grows sideways? We'll tell you. We'll also tell you about some of the fabulous benefits this plant conveys to your entire landscape. After a lot more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Jessica, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Jessica. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am just ducky today. Thank you for asking. Where is Jessica good?
Jessica's good from Mays Landing from Oakcrest High School. We have a couple questions about our greenhouse that we run through our environmental program.
Oh, that's great. So you're in high school and the high school has a greenhouse.
Yes. I'm a senior at Oakcrest High School, and C Club, which is an environmental club through our teacher, Mr. Mark, we ran a greenhouse, and we do a lot of different other environmental programs around the community.
Oh, that's fabulous, because, you know, there's all this interest in having, quote, school gardens, but in most situations in the Northeast, the gardening year is totally different from the school year. But when you have a greenhouse, you can really use that thing all school year long and learn so much from it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We go down as classes and we'll plant things, we'll transplant, and we try to save different plants, like if people ask us. But recently we've had an issue with aphids. We planted tomatoes, herbs, and lettuce, and we transplanted some from outside, and that's what we think the contamination came from. But make a long story short, we had to get rid of all of our plants because the contamination became too bad.
Right.
So our question to you is, do you know how to disinfect it properly, any ways of preventing it? And we also have exposed soil, like bag soil already, mm-hmm. and is that contaminated as well?
No.
No, it's not?
No, it's not contaminated. So the interesting thing about a pest like an aphid, which is a tiny insect that sucks sap from plants, but even though it's tiny, they can quickly breed into numbers in the thousands and then multiple thousands, and they overwhelm plants, and they are probably one of the top three pest problems in greenhouses. So in the future, when you bring plants into a greenhouse, there should be a 2 or 3 step stage. When you get the plant ready to bring it in its pot or whatever, you should have a staging area with a hose that delivers a sharp stream of water. And then you want to blast that sucker. You don't care if you lose a couple of leaves, because those leaves are going to fall off anyway. But you really want to blast every little corner, every little crotch of that plant, every little leaf surface with water. Then ideally, you would move it into a small greenhouse, kind of like an airlock greenhouse, and you would let it sit there for a day or two, examine it carefully, do the water treatment again, and then bring it into the main greenhouse. I bring my peppers in from the outside every winter, and almost always the aphids will appear around Christmas, and I'll really have to knock them down or else they'll take over. So it's a very common problem. But pests cannot survive without hosts. So your aphids don't have any plants to feed on right now.
That is right.
And it's winter. So one of the things you can do, if you have the option, is you can open up the greenhouse, make sure all the water is drained, make sure nothing's going to get damaged. But you can open up the greenhouse and let it sit open on a couple of really cold nights. The corollary in the summertime, which a lot of people do because greenhouses get too hot, is they will close up their greenhouses in the summertime and let that really cook the pests out. But without the plants, when you took the plants out and trashed the plants, the majority of the aphids went along with them. So after a week or so with nothing to eat, there shouldn't be any aphids left around. One of the things you want to do you have yellow sticky traps out in your greenhouse?
Not currently, no.
Okay. That would be good for monitoring. You want to get those yellow sticky traps. In a greenhouse situation, you really need to buy them in bulk, by the hundreds, by the thousands. And just put those up in the different corners of your greenhouse and watch those to see if any insects land on them. You can also put in a test plant of some kind, something that aphids love. If somebody has a rose or a pepper plant, something like that, put it in the greenhouse and just watch it. If it gets by and it isn't infested within a few days, then your aphid situation is over for now. In the future, what we used to do, when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine and we raised plants in greenhouses over the winter for the Philadelphia Flower Show, is we would buy a beneficial insect called the green lacewing. They're very easy to find. There are suppliers all over the country. And what you get is you get these little cardboard cards with eggs on them, and you put them in the greenhouse. And you put these cards around the greenhouse, the eggs hatch, and out come what are called aphid lions, these little larvae that look a little like alligators. They're brightly colored. And each one of these larvae will eat 40 to 50 aphids a day. They are,
wow.
They are tremendous. Yeah, the insect's common name in this stage is the aphid lion. It's the biggest predator. Everybody talks about ladybugs, but lacewings.
Yeah, that's what we had researched, because actually through trying to like do a natural way of getting rid of them, we made a spray. It's like a 32-ounce spray bottle. We put natural baby soap and apple cider vinegar in it, and it seemed to help a little bit, but at that point it was too far. Now, real quick, I just want to go back to something that you said earlier about your peppers.
Mm-hmm.
You said to knock them down. What exactly are you knocking them down with again?
Oh, just sharp streams of water.
Sharp streams of water? Okay.
Yeah, water is the best insecticide. If you go and read journal articles about growing roses indoors in Great Britain, they've even developed specialized nozzles that deliver sharp streams of water. There's a famous research study that was done that compared soap sprays and sprays of horticultural oil with sprays of commercial insecticide, and the researchers figured, well, we need some sort of control. So they used a sharp spray of water without any soap or oil or insecticide as, quote, the control. And it was the most effective. It killed outright over 90% of the aphids, just the sharp spray of water. But it, you know, we're not talking about a gentle washing. We're talking about a laser-like stream of water that will sting your hand when it hits it.
Oh, okay.
But again, this is so important. If you had your greenhouse this year and everything had been hunky-dory and you hadn't had the experience, you would have learned nothing. But now that you've had this infestation of aphids, now you've had the experience of a commercial grower. This happens to everyone sooner or later. Commercial greenhouses are constantly getting in front of this, constantly releasing green lacewings into the greenhouse, hanging lots of traps, monitoring the plants really carefully. Like I said, having one of their favorite plants, like a rose or a pepper plant, growing in every section of the greenhouse, because that's where they're going to appear first. So then you know you need to release a lot of lacewings or get in there and really hose the plants down sharp. Gardeners learn nothing from success. We learn brilliantly from failure. Failure trains us to go out in the world and expect problems and to be ready to solve them, or if we get really good at it, to get in front of the problems, to have learned over the years how to prevent them.
Right. Thank you very much. I think that answers our question perfectly, and we will be sure to do what you told us to do.
Excellent. All right, Jess, what a pleasure to speak with you. Good luck.
Thank you. Nice speaking to you, too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Paul, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
I'm Mike. How are you?
I'm not bad today, Paul. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, thanks.
And where is Paul doing great?
We're in Warrington, Pennsylvania.
Just outside of Philadelphia.
Right.
All right. What can we do for Paul in Warrington?
We have three young potted rose bushes temporarily in our house sitting on a southeast-facing windowsill. And we got these by taking cuttings last June from an old sentimental rose bush that has been in our family for about 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
And two of the three cuttings are showing signs of distress by repeatedly dropping their leaves, and it's happened twice now. And the leaves get dry and crispy and then fall off, and it progresses from the base on up to the top of the cane.
Well, you know, I don't think the symptoms really matter much, Paul. Where's the mother rose?
The mother rose initially was grown in the Fairmount section of Philadelphia. It was my mother's rose, and then we had to sell the house, and we divided the rose bush. It turned out to be two root systems, and I took one and my sister took one. And in the 7 years that have transpired, we've moved that rose, my rose, three times, and it finally died. I think it was shocked by all the moves. And then I went over to my sister's house, whose rose bush was thriving, and I took cuttings from that, and she lives in New Jersey.
Okay.
And of the 8 cuttings, 3 have now survived, and the 2 are in distress.
Right, and I have to think that her rose is growing in the ground.
Yes, she's got hers outside, and what we plan on doing after these cuttings, we hope to take them outside, transplant them, and have them nicely in our garden outside. So in the cutting stage, when these 3 started to grow, we have them inside protected and in a nice environment, and then they took off, and now we have this problem.
Yeah, protected from what, really? Because really, what you ended up protecting them from was the natural cycle of nature. I mean, if you go down south, yes, roses will grow all year long. They might, depending on where you are, go through a short period of dormancy. But if you look outside at any rose bush that was fabulous this past summer and will be fabulous this coming summer, right now it looks like you're dead indoor plants, right? All the leaves are dropped. It's all, you know, it doesn't.
Right. And one of them is doing great, but the other 2 are not. And we have them inside because I was told with these sensitive and baby cuttings, you know, I had them in a terrarium environment, and then they started to grow and take off, and it started to become cold outside, and I was too afraid in their young state to plop them outside in the soil. So we were told we can keep them inside and then transplant them in the spring outside.
Well, I think that was pretty poor advice. I mean, as long as the cuttings had developed good roots, they should have been planted outside in the fall. And if you took the cuttings at the right time of year, which is early spring, then...
Yeah, we did it in June.
What?
We did it at the end of June.
That's not the best time.
Yeah.
But the Jersey rose is still alive, right?
Correct.
Yeah, that's the new name of the rose, by the way, the Jersey rose. So
a beautiful rose. I have to say, though, when we inspected these roses recently, a couple of days ago, we can see these very tiny, tiny, tiny spider webs with mites on them, and I'm thinking that'd be the problem.
Yes, you have spider mites, it sounds like, which is due to the dry indoor conditions of winter. But if you want to try to save, I think you said you have 1 plant left or a couple of plants left, what you want to do is just be misting them down heavily every morning. And then you're going to have a bear of a job trying to harden these off in the spring, getting them outside without them going into shock.
What should I do?
You'd have to harden them off. When people start putting their tomatoes in their garden, you'd take the roses outside, leave them out for a couple hours the first day, not in bright sun or direct light. Bring them in, take them out for progressively longer periods, leave them out overnight, try to keep the direct sun off them for the first couple weeks, then plant them in the spot where you want them and water the heck out of them the first week with just a drip at the base of the plant.
But in terms of sun, what should they get? Should it be morning sun? Like, what location should it be? A morning sun and then nothing? Or, you know, what area of the garden should they be put in outside? So in terms of the sun,
roses will die without morning sun, but they can take full day sun in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Now, in the spring, about 3 weeks after her rose starts growing again, I want you to go over and I want you to take a whole bunch of cuttings, bring them home using plastic pots with good drainage. Fill the pots with good seed starting mix or a sterile potting mix, a soil-free mix, not garden dirt, and nothing with chemical fertilizers or water-holding crystals in it. And then saturate the mix. You put these pots filled with this light mixture into a sink. You may have to put a brick on top of each one to hold it down while it absorbs the water. But then the mix will become saturated. Then you'll take a pencil and you'll poke a little hole into the soil on top. And then you'll recut the bottom of one of the cuttings and you'll drop it in. You won't push it in. And then you'll hill up the soil around it, and then you'll keep that pot really well watered. Make sure there's no water in the dish under it, but don't let the soil dry out. Just keep it natural room light till it starts growing again, and then take it outside, put it in a spot where it gets about half day sun. At this point, it doesn't matter much. And then, as long as it's still growing, just put the little plant in the ground in September in a spot that gets full morning sun.
Okay.
Those cuttings are going to do better than your roses that have been denied the dormant period.
Okay.
If you got one that looks really good, you can give it a try. But as long as you've still got that parent rose, you're in yes. good shape. So take the cuttings really early in the spring, 3 weeks after growth appears. You know, put them into a nice soil-free mix. Keep that mix moist. You'll be able to tell when they start growing roots because it'll start putting on new leaves and everything.
Yep.
And then just baby that plant through the summer and then mm-hmm. plant it in the ground in the late summer, early fall, as soon as the biggest heat wave breaks, and water it every day. It doesn't rain, by just dripping a hose at the base for an hour. And then once we get regular rains or, you know, it starts to get really cold, the rose will take care of itself.
Okay, great.
All right, good luck, Paul.
Thank you very much, Mike. Appreciate it.
Take care, man.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at the fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show at 4 p.m. on Wednesday, March 15th. At the Master Gardener's Spring Symposium in Fayetteville, North Carolina on March 25th. And in beautiful State College, PA, April 6th through the 8th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with Fabulous Forsythia and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm absolutely fabulous, Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in, again, more than fabulous Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will get to the question of the week. What does it mean when Forsythia grows sideways? More important than that, we're going to tell you all the unseen benefits this giant spring bloomer can bring to your landscape. People with Japanese beetle troubles, stay tuned. You won't want to miss this. And you won't. It's coming up right after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Karen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Karen. How are you?
I'm great.
And where is Karen great?
I am great in West Mount Airy.
Okay. What is up with Karen in Mount Airy?
So I have a palm tree. It's actually two palm trees, And these are trees that I purchased when I was in Florida in 2003. They came in a very small pot, and at the time they were about 6 to 8 inches tall. And they've basically been kept inside their entire life.
Right.
And I've been repotting them, and now they've grown to probably be about 3 and 5 feet tall.
That's a good size.
And, yeah, so they've been inside, but probably over the last 6 to 9 months, the leaves have started to turn brown. And it's not just like the lower fronds. It's basically on the smaller plant, it's throughout most of the leaves except for the top three fronds. And on a taller plant, it's some scattered leaves. So I don't know if it's a watering issue or, you know, maybe it needs to be repotted again, or if it's the soil or the nutrients, but it hasn't been doing well, and I'm hoping you can give me some advice to resurrect it.
Well, there's a lot of different house plants that fall under the generic term of palms, but they all pretty much show the same kind of symptoms. Now, are the leaves at all yellow before they turn brown?
I think they pretty much go straight to brown.
Okay.
And some thrush fronds have just brown tips, but a lot of them, it's like all the leaves are basically all brown down to the kind of main stalk of the frond. The curious thing is it actually still has new shoots coming out the
good.
Top.
Okay, that's good. Now, are both plants kind of looking the same?
The smaller one is definitely worse.
And are they in radically different places in the house?
No, I mean, they actually kind of came together in the same pot, so they've always been in the same pot.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. Yeah. All right, and what is your watering habit? Are you a worry wart, or are you forgetful?
I'm more forgetful.
Okay. So, leaves with brown tips, dry air is the most common problem, and underwatering. Palms in general are tropical plants. They're used to being moist. You know, all house plants should kind of dry out between waterings, but palm trees less so. What would rot out the roots of another plant probably won't hurt a palm tree, especially if the larger tree has gotten real big and there's not a lot of soil left in the pot. You know, over time, the root ball tends to displace the soil. And these plants don't mind being, quote, root bound. But, you know, when you don't have a lot of soil left in the pot compared to the biomass of the plant, there's not anything, there's no sponge down there to absorb and hold water. So I want you to do two things. I want you to get on a little more of a schedule with watering, be more frequent. It is better to keep these plants a little on the moist side rather than let them dry out.
Okay.
And I think your plants would perk up tremendously if you would start misting them. Get a misting bottle and just spray the leaves every morning. They would absolutely love you. And that would also help insure them against any, you know, forgetful watering, because these plants are very good at taking water in through their leaves.
Okay.
I think a little heavier hand with the watering, and especially the misting, these things are going to perk right up.
Okay.
All right.
That sounds great.
All right. Good luck, Karen.
All right. Thanks so much, Mike.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Susan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Susan. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And you?
I am just ducky today, thank you. Where is Susan Fine?
Beaver Creek, Ohio.
Excellent.
Dayton.
Always a pleasure to hear from our listeners in that neck of the woods. What a great public radio station you have there.
91.3 WYSO.
There you go. They love it when you do that. All right, what can we do for Susan in Beaver Creek, Ohio?
Okay. I want to plant some cherry trees. My husband and I bought our house 19 years ago. It had 3 mature cherry trees, a tart cherry, a red sweet, and a yellow sweet.
Mm-hmm.
We very much enjoyed them. a few years ago, the tart tree died. We took it out. The red sweet is losing a branch or two a year. It's not got that much life left in it. So we want to replace those two trees. I know you say plant trees in the fall. I know you say buy locally. So last fall, I checked all the local nurseries. None of them had sweet cherries, particularly dwarfs, because I don't want cherries if they're 40 feet in the air.
Right.
But I couldn't find what I needed. And when I looked at the trees they did have, they all had tags that said that they were grown hundreds of miles away, which kind of makes the whole buy locally thing seem a little less real. It's very tempting to go online now. I see reputable seed companies, nurseries that have the products I want available now, bare root, given shipping dates of like the first week in March. And I'm thinking, okay, what do I do with a bare root tree the first week of March in Beaver Creek, Ohio?
You would take it out of its box. You would examine it. You would get a sprayer. You would mist it down with water without soaking it. And you would put it in the fridge until your soil was dry and warm enough to plant it. That's where they are now. They're in giant refrigerated areas waiting to be shipped.
Okay, I was looking at something 5 feet tall, and my fridge isn't that big.
Okay. So good. You're going to buy a good-sized plant. In that case, you do exactly what I said. You unpack the box, you check it, give it a little spritz with water, and then you put it outside in its box in a protected area, and you watch the weather. And as long as it's not too hot and it's not too cold, you just leave it outside. But if you're going to get a 60-degree day, you move it into the coldest part of your basement or your garage. If it's going to drop down to 20, you move it into a warmer place in your basement or your garage. And if you're buying a 5-foot-high tree, you can probably tell them, don't ship this before April 1st.
Okay. So is that what time you think they should ship it?
Really, with a tree that's going to be coming out of dormancy in the spring, the only important thing is that the soil is dry enough to work. You know, if you had a heavy snow or lots of rain in the weeks before, it doesn't matter what the temperature is. You need to work dry soil. And cherries really also need not so much dry soil, but soil that drains exceptionally well. Now, I have to say I'm shocked that you had sweet cherries because they are not reliably productive in your region because you have cold winters and you have hot summers. So technically, they can be grown in certain areas in your region, but they generally don't thrive really well.
Our neighbors put in improved Rainiers about 3 years ago, and they seem to be doing fine.
Good, good, good. You might be in the right microclimate. Just remember that with sweet cherries, you do need two different varieties to cross-pollinate them.
Okay. Do they have to be two different varieties of sweet cherries?
Yes, and they have to produce their flowers at around the same time. That's how cross-pollination works. Bees go from one tree to the other, and the flowers have to be open at the same time. Now, I'm not sure what kind of success you've had looking for, quote, dwarf cherry trees. Maybe there have been some improvements in the last couple of years. But especially with sweet cherries, you tend not to be able to find trees that are going to stay very small.
The ones that the nursery's calling dwarf, they say will grow up to 14 feet tall. That's not totally dwarf, but it beats the 18-foot
Right.
Semi-dwarf.
Right. No, that makes sense. And I would suggest, however, that a true semi-dwarf variety might be a much healthier plant. And, you know, even though cherry trees don't need pruning, that doesn't mean you're not allowed to prune them to keep them in bounds, especially for the first 5-10 years.
Mm-hmm. With regard to the cross-pollination, as I said, we started with 3 cherries and we have about 1.5 left. The survivor is a yellow cherry, which is probably a Stella or something like that.
Right.
It's within a week or so of bloom time of the other. I mean, the ones I've looked at all claim they're self-pollinating, but I've been listening to your show long enough to know that doesn't necessarily mean self-pollinating.
Correct. No, your tart cherry is self-pollinating. It does not need another variety. But I don't think it can help your sweet cherry. So you can probably use your existing yellow cherry as a pollinating partner. But I would also urge you, if you're going to buy new trees, to buy two new trees of different varieties that are known to be good pollinators of each other.
Okay.
All right, Suze?
Okay, good. Yes. Thank you.
Take care.
You too. Goodbye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. What to do when forsythia becomes a ground cover? Alexis Landis, erstwhile producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started reading this week's question, please.
I will give it my best shot. Jason in Kettering, Ohio writes, I currently have a forsythia that is growing along the ground. I heavily pruned it after flowering last year, after letting it grow out of control for years. Is there something I should do to control it now, or just leave it be? Mike, didn't you once famously try and fail to kill a forsythia?
Oh, yeah. There were three huge shrubs in front of our house when we moved in. They bloomed magnificently in the spring, an amazing burst of bright yellow. But I needed to plant some other things out there and tried to dig the center one up. I finally had to host a forsythia removal party. It took like eight guys to pull the enormous root ball out of the ground, which then lay there on its side for a week until I could convince, notice that the prefix of that word is con, a different bunch of guys to come over, and we finally were able to muscle it into the woods.
Where I hear that it continues to bloom every spring some 20 years later on its side.
Yes, forsythia is, quote, easy to grow, a phrase that has many meanings. But the survival of that specimen is a clue as to what's going on with Jason's plants in Kettering.
And that is?
A technique called layering. Some plants can be propagated simply by pressing one of their branches down against the soil. Sometimes you need to put a rock on top to keep the soil contact, but with forsythia and tomatoes, a branch that drops down low enough will do this naturally.
Tomatoes?
Absolutely. If you grow one of those big vining indeterminate varieties without proper support, any of the branches that touch the soil are going to send down roots. Some gardeners in long season climates will deliberately do this. They'll put out plants without support, wait a week, sever the rooted portions, and move them to different locations. It's also a good way to salvage a damaged plant if you find it early in the season.
So your Lazarus plant isn't unique. Do a lot of forsythia grow sideways?
Oh, yeah. Now, the only question is this related to the heavy pruning, which, by the way, was performed at the correct time of year, right after the plants finished blooming? Or did Jason just reduce the height enough to notice all the lateral growth for the first time? My shrubs often send up aerial shoots that are 15 feet tall, which is always pulling your eyes up high. But I've also learned to look down low, and so I'm always pulling out crawlers in between the plants.
My goodness, it sounds like running bamboo.
Which, by the way, has been in the news a lot lately. It's being outlawed in many communities because its invasiveness can undermine the structural integrity of buildings and roadways. But I can't put forsythia in that rogues gallery. It isn't that hard to control. My, quote, layered plants pull up pretty easily from wet soil. And more importantly, the spectacular spring display the plant puts on attracts a slew of beneficial insects.
Is that because of the sheer number of flowers, their size, that there aren't a lot of other plants in bloom at that time?
Yes, times three plus two. The number of individual flowers on a mature plant can almost be beyond comprehension. Those individual flowers are smallish, and small flowers attract the greatest diversity of pollinators and beneficials. And yes, early spring bloomers like forsythia are crucial to the long-term survival of insects that both pollinate our food crops and prey on pests. But, as they say on TV, there's more.
A free ShamWow with every shrub?
Just pay a separate handling fee. Seriously, forsythia flowers are yellow, and yellow is the favorite color of hundreds of species of native bees. Non-stinging, solitary nesting creatures of all shapes and sizes that provide pollination for many of our fruits and flowers. But that's not all.
We'll double your order.
No, but we will cut in half the number of grubs in your soil before they can emerge as plant-destroying Japanese beetles, June beetles, rose chafers, and other destructive members of the scarab beetle family. Forsythia is one of the plants that produce what are called extrafloral nectaries, glands that are not involved in pollination, but that pump out massive amounts of sugar. One of the insects most attracted to forsythia sugar is a predator known as the spring tiptia wasp. It gets an energy boost from the sugar water and then hovers over the nearby soil, listening for the distinctive vibrations of awakening grubs.
Then she, it's always the females who do the actual work, burrows down into the soil, stings and paralyzes the grub, and lays an egg whose occupant will feed off the dying grub.
Exactly right. That baby predator will then spend the summer, fall, and winter underground and emerge as a new adult wasp in the spring to sugar up on forsythia blooms and attack that year's grubs.
A nice story. But how effective are they?
50% control or better. In a study performed in Connecticut, 61% of Japanese beetle grubs had been, quote, impacted by the wasp. That works out to you having half as many beetles ravaging your roses. Well, that sure was some interesting information about forsythia now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to improperly prune my forsythia if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org.
Please, please, please include your location.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find the answers to all those questions you were going to email us without your location. Audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website creeping along. Spring blooming Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Friend to Wasps is our editor, Al Banks. Our intern, Michael Inglés, has never been known to attack a grub, which is good news to me, grubby Mike McGrath, because it means I will probably be able to see you again next week. Brick walkways are great if you're a weed looking for a place to live. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal how picking Charlie Weaver to block is your only answer. Plus your fabulous phone calls.